you like our owl?
How many questions does it usually take to spot one?
I don't get it, Tyrell.
How many questions?
20, 30 cross-referenced.
Fiery the angels fell. Deep thunder rolled around their shores, burning with the fires of Orc.
You and your models are happy scraping the shit. Because you've never seen a miracle.
You imagined it was you. Oh, you did. You did. We all wish it was us. That's why we believe.
All the best memories are hers.
Welcome to Shoulder of Orion, the Blade Runner podcast. I am your host, Jamie Prater. I'm joined by my co-host,
Patrick Green, my friend. Hey.
How you doing? It's just me and you today. How about that?
Back just to the two of
back
us.
Back to the roots.
Make it if we try. Although next episode, I think we're going to have more voices in the conversation again. That Cyberpunk episode, I have to say, that was one of my favorites. I think that was really good. That was like truly one of my favorite episodes of the show we've ever done. Like that's one of the ones where I like sent it to people who don't even like listen to the podcast. I was like, I think this conversation is really cool. And they loved it because largly because TR and AT were both such amazing guests, but also I think we brought a little something to it.
Agreed. You know? Agreed.
I think we kind of learned on the fly and asked interesting questions. It felt like a really interesting episode to me.
It did. It really did. It felt different for us. It felt fresh. And we're going to continue covering that, as everyone knows. It'll probably even go into our Alien podcast, so stay tuned for that.
Yeah, big plans in that area, too. But of course, you know, tonight we're going to talk about some news and also some more speculation about 2099. But before we get to that, we have to do a little bit of an in memoriam segment for somebody that we lost just recently, which is M. Emmett Walsh, who, of course, played Bryant in Blade Runner. He died March 19th at the age of 88. He was just an indelible presence in American screens for over, I think, 200-something credits that I saw.
Wow.
I mean, he was a huge presence, you know, in everything from Serpico to Critters to, of course, Blade Runner to many other things, but also on TV for a long time. And he's just one of those guys who showed up in so many different places and brought such an amazing, you know, presence to his roles. I think part of why he was such a great fit for Bryant is because his the way that he came across was so hard to read sometimes, because he kind of came across intimidating in some ways, partly because he had this kind of burly presence. You know, he had this like kind of accent. He just sort of came across like somewhat intimidating, but then he also kind of felt playful underneath that, this interesting sort of juxtaposition of those two qualities. And I think as Bryant, like, he was just so intoxicating to watch. Partly because it was kind of hard to tell exactly what he was thinking. Like, you know, we did a whole anatomy of a scene when he's watching with Deckard in the screening room in the LAPD, going through the files with him. And, you know, and it's kind of unclear exactly what he's talking about or what he's thinking about. Mm-hmm. And he's trying to read Deckard as Deckard is, you know, responding to him. It's just, he was an actor who I think visually, you know, you would think he'd be kind of like a simple, you know, kind of just character actor, kind of burly tough guy, but he actually was a lot more than that. And I think we got, you know, some wonderful films from him.
I would agree. I recently saw Serpico and saw him in it. I think he was a wonderful talent, and one part of his charm as Bryant is that he fell right into that classic Hollywood film noir, like, so he would be like the lieutenant, the boss, and he just embodied that beautifully. But there was also a tenderness about him as well, where he had a job to do and he knew it, and he was a bit of a slave driver, or just like a taskmaster. But at the same time, you could see in his eyes a glint of, I know this sucks. It sucks for you and it sucks for me too, but this is it. This is the life that we're living. And the fact that he could balance that and play that with his eyes, play that with his face, really play that gambit of emotions as this bit of a tough guy character, I thought it was really great. And he's always been a great character actor. He's always played similar roles in his career, but he's just got such amazing charisma, and it is a sad loss, but I'm glad he lived a long life.
Hiya, Dick.
Brian.
You wouldn't have come if I just asked you to. Sit down, pal. Come on, don't be an asshole, Decker. I've got four skin jobs walking the streets.
Another role that, you know, people might not realize was him is in one of my favorite films ever, especially animated films, The Iron Giant from 99. He plays Earl Stutz, who's the captain, or the, you know, he's, I don't know if he's a captain, but he's, you know, piloting a boat in the beginning of the movie and sees, you know, the Iron Giant, and nobody's believing him, and they think he's kind of crazy and, you know, a drunkard. And then he ends up, you know, of course, being vindicated because the Iron Giant actually has come to this little town in coastal Maine. And it's another role that's just, it's just, he just shows up in these parts and brings so much life to them, you know? And I think it's, we're just really lucky that we had him on Blade Runner. I feel like we're at a point now where both Blade Runner and Alien is really, really losing a lot of the talent who was on them. Like, so many people are gone at this point. And I know we're really feeling that a little more acutely, I think, with Alien, just because, you know, so many cast members in the last 10 years or so have died. But it is happening with Blade Runner too, and it's just really it's really unfortunate. Something else I think is really interesting about Walsh is, you know, he was raised in this tiny town in the very northwest corner of Vermont, right along the border with Quebec. We actually just drove through that area. We went up to Montreal last weekend, and it is like just the furthest thing from Hollywood, you know what I mean? And the United States, like, it does not get less Hollywood than Franklin County, Vermont. And yet he, you know, and then he had this amazing career, did all these hundreds of movies, and then he also died there. Like, he returned, I would imagine he probably still lived in Vermont for most of his career. He just would fly out, do a show, and come back. And I think you kind of, that charm kind of comes through a little bit. Like, you kind of feel where he came from a little bit in these roles. Like, he doesn't feel like he's part of the Hollywood sort of system. He doesn't feel like very mainstream. He feels kind of like he's kind of an outsider almost. And maybe I'm reading into it, you know, because his biography is kind of like leading me to do that. But it does kind of feel that way. Like, Bryant, to me, it doesn't feel like an actor playing this captain in a detective story. It really feels like, I don't know, like he's a real person. Like a real kind of weirdo, you know, in the best possible, you know, use of that word. Just
a real kind of weirdo.
You know what I mean? Because he was. And I think actually he said this in interviews. He was like, you know, I was never going to be a great Shakespearean actor because, like, I talked funny and looked a little weird. You know what I mean? Like, he wasn't like this, like, dashing, you know, Hollywood machine churned out.
For sure. Thing. He was a quintessential character actor. That's what he is.
Yeah.
A very specific kind of character as well, where he's not like a character actor like Gary Oldman is, where Gary Oldman can play all these. Bryant, M. Emmett Walsh played a very specific kind of guy in a lot of his films.
Yeah. And just anchored those performances beautifully. Yes. And like that's what you want when you there's definitely a type of role that thrives when you have somebody who's just kind of just nail it like that. You know what I mean? And that's what really Scott needed for Bryant. Something else just funny about that he's talked about in a couple of places is how he really had no clue what was going on when he made the movie. Walsh, like, he was like, honestly, I didn't really understand what the story was supposed to be about. You know, I showed up and I knew who my character was, and, you know, I performed it. And then, you know, I saw the screening of it, and he said, you know, many of us that were in the movie together were just sort of staring at it in silence, being like, that was the movie we made. Like, he had no idea the larger machinations going on in that film, which, again, it just leads me to this whole, like, outsider place. It's almost like he was from the outside looking in, you know?
Yeah. Interesting. I definitely think he's a thread in the fabric of a set of actors that do not exist anymore. The industry has changed so much. You just don't see people like him. You just don't. There's very few actors who can embody the characters the way that he does. He's from an old form of the Hollywood system that is gone, whereas everything's being conglomerated and, you know, more studios are kind of combining, or they're being bought by Amazon or Disney or whatever. But yeah, he's definitely the product of an era gone by, and he will greatly be missed.
They jumped a shuttle off world, killed the crew and passengers. We found the shuttle drifting off the coast 2 weeks ago, so we know they're around.
Embarrassing.
No, sir, not embarrassing, because no one's ever going to find out they're down here. But you're going to spot them, and you're going to air them out.
I don't work here anymore. Give it to Holden. He's good.
I did. He can breathe okay as long as nobody unplugs him. It's not good enough. Not good as you. I need you, Dex. Now, this is a bad one. The worst yet. I need the old Blade Runner. I need your magic.
You know, before we sort of transition into the next part of the episode, I do want to make sure we read some patron names, because we actually got a bunch this month. And if any of you have remembrances of him or roles that he was in that you really loved, you know, please write in, because we'd like to do more of like a formal sort of goodbye to him at some point. So, you know, if you have anything else you'd like to add to the conversation, please send it to our email at bladerunnerpodcast@gmail.com or reach out on social media and, you know, we'll try to get your thoughts in there. So thank you so much to Matt H., Joshua Holko, Michael Burns, Natasha Matthews, Glenn Burfield, Matt Garza, and Xenopred Alien. I'm assuming that's your birth name. Thank you for joining our Patreon. We are so excited to have you. There's lots of cool stuff coming out, as you know. And we are, something that we've been kind of playing around with is the idea of having like exclusive Blade Runner Patreon content, sort of like we do now for Alien with the Hive series. So if you have ideas for that, you know, please also reach out to us. We'd love to hear your thoughts on it. I think that's something that, you know, we're really, would be really great for us to do. So, you know, hopefully it'll happen.
The next part of our show, we really wanted to kind of bring everyone up to speed on what's going on with 2099. We did recently just cover this, but there's been a little bit more news. So the news is that 2099 has moved production from Belfast to Prague in the Czech Republic. And that is based off some of the things that we've seen, which were official. Production is going to begin on June 30th. Which I believe is the same day Kay sat in. Wasn't it June 30th that he was sitting in for his baseline test in 2049? I have to double check that.
I do not remember.
It's sometime in June. At any rate, it's great that there is movement. Again, this is a show by Amazon, a live action Blade Runner show that's going to be 10 episodes long, an hour each, based off what Ridley Scott has said. The directors are lined up. Writing is done. Sets are being built right now. So it's going to be an exciting time. It's going to be probably, definitely the show won't come out until probably mid next year. I'm thinking summer of 2025.
It's slated for April of 2025.
Really? Right now. Okay. Which yeah. They could completely do. I also, when the local industry outlet, like publishing outlet in Prague, published this thing saying that it was going to, the production is going to shoot from June to November, and that'll be it. So that would give them like early November, like November 3rd. So like rest of November, December, January, February, March, April. That's 6 months. Plus they're doing post already, or they start doing post right away. So yeah, that would be great. I mean, we're going to have an Alien series and a Blade Runner series both in the same year. It's going to be absolutely fucking nuts.
Yeah, it is going to be nuts. Also, you know, kind of recent news is we had the Jeremy Padeswa, who was going to be directing the first two episodes, has been replaced by Jonathan Van Tulleken, who is most currently getting buzz for his work on Shogun, FX's amazing series. You know, are you watching that, Jamie?
Absolutely. It's fucking amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's beautiful. So that bodes, I think, very well for 2099. That's really great. And of course, you know, as Jamie was mentioning, this is big news also because this was so up in the air for so long that it kind of felt like it was in jeopardy of not happening. Production was halted all the way back in summer 2023 when it was, you know, in motion in Belfast. And
we should have been getting the show this year. Yeah.
Yeah. And it really got hugely delayed by that at a pretty, you know, precipitous moment. So this is all really good news. Like this is definitely happening. And like I said, it's set to come out on Prime Video in April of 2025 of this point. It's just weird. It's also weird saying those words out loud. It feels very Blade Runner to be saying that we're going to have like a Blade Runner series coming out on Amazon Prime Video. You know, like what the hell's going on?
Yeah.
Corporate subterfuge. But anyway, it's okay because they're paying for it and that's really great. You know, of course, yeah, we moved away from Belfast to Prague, which is, I think, you know, going to be a nice change of pace for them.
Why do you think that they moved that? Let me just, what?
Yeah, well, so, you know, this decision was made, you know, after it resumed production post writer strike, right? So it could have been that something, you know, was being shot on the same soundstage or something that, you know, that it got bumped. You know, that could be, what do you think?
Perhaps they had already given like $2 million towards the production to the local industry, like hub there that they had to pay back or something like that. I don't know. I mean, Prague, it would kind of fall in line in terms of visually with Budapest. Like they're kind of similar in their style of, in terms of like the region of the world that they're at. So it would make some aesthetic sense for aesthetic continuity that they would shoot it in an area that looks similar to where Denis Villeneuve shot 2049. On the outset, I don't really know. I also know that Prague is probably cheaper than Dublin, for sure.
Belfast.
Oh, yeah, Belfast, sorry. Definitely cheaper. So I think it's better for these productions to, you know, get more for their money. So they go to cheaper, you know, they go to cheaper studios. Aside from that, I don't know. I might've said this before. I really hope that if there are scenes that take place in LA in this series, because this is a limited series, from what we know, it's only going to be these 10 episodes and that's it. There's not going to be, which I'm happy about. I want a full story. We do know that even though this is like for Alien, like I know that Noah Hawley is talking about multiple seasons for that, which is fine. I tend to like stories like limited series because it's a full story. You have 10 hours or whatever to tell a full story. I tend to like that as opposed to something that kind of goes on and on and on. So that gives me hope. But I hope if they are filming scenes that are taking place in LA, that they take the time to go to LA and find whatever spot they're going to shoot and shoot it, just to kind of bring LA back into the fold as this iconic place where Blade Runner like ends or takes place. I would imagine, my thoughts are, this series is going to end in LA. It's going to end where it began somehow. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe. I think that could definitely work. I also think that I would say that there is probably less than 10% chance they film anything on location in Los Angeles, honestly, because it's not a movie for one thing too, right? We're talking about a television series that's very long, that is, you know, funded by Prime Video, that's already in production, you know, in a very different part of the world. Mm-hmm. And as we've seen, the precedent for basically all television now is using things like The Volume to get, you know, that kind of stuff shot. Unfortunately, I think that'd be great though, if they could do that.
I really hope that they utilize the volume very little. Like the volume has really been, I think the volume has been overplayed. And I think you can see it in other shows where it looks cheap, where the show looks cheap because they're shooting in front of a screen. And with inept people or people who don't really know how to shoot with the volume, you can see it's like everything's kind of in the middle and you have this amazing background, but there's no interaction with that set because it's not a set. It's just an image. But I really hope they go light on the volume. I think Blade Runner will be best served making this as real as possible. I can imagine the people behind it know this. I don't really know. I'm just nervous about the show.
I think you have every right to be, but it's also worth pointing out that, well, I don't know if this is actually good or bad, but Alcon, of course, is producing this.
Mm-hmm. Of course. Yeah.
They did bring us 2049. They also let Black Lotus happen. So, you know.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah.
But, you know, so they greenlit this project in September of 2022, I believe. That's when that happened.
Mm.
So this has had a long gestational process by this point, which I think is a good thing.
I agree.
I think that's great, because I think that means, and the fact that it's still happening is also important, right? It shows that they have commitment and passion. They're waiting till they can do it properly. They did not let this fall apart during the strikes. They, you know, they kind of saw it through to the end. Silke Louisa has been attached to it this entire time, even as her star has risen for other projects. Like, she's still going to be the showrunner. You know, they have this extremely prestigious, you know, very hot right now guy who's going to be running, you know, basically determining the look and feel of the show by directing the first two episodes. You know, like all these things I think bode really well. Like it seems like it's slated to do well. I think also, you know, my feelings on this are very much influenced by all of the talk that we've been doing recently on Romulus, the alien film coming out, which I have to say, we've been a little sidetracked by that lately, just as a podcast, because we've had to cover so much alien stuff lately. So apologies for that. But it feels nice to be kind of coming back around to Blade Runner again. The reason I'm saying that is because we've been talking so much about Alien Romulus and the teaser that came out a couple weeks ago as we record this, and remarking on why that teaser felt so good to so many of us. I mean, I know for both you and I, like that teaser was like incredibly exciting. There's a lot of reasons for it. One is it captured the authentic feel of Alien in a really great way. It also showcased practical effects. It showcased like a really tightly constrained set, like a set that has a lot of detail and thought put into it. It's not trying to be everything, you know. I think those are all characteristics that I want to see. And maybe this is something we can talk about for a moment too. When we get that teaser for 2099, you know, so fast forward right now to maybe the end of this year, maybe, November 19th would be a really good time to see something, right?
That'd be great.
That'll also be coinciding with when they're wrapping the production. So like, that'll be a pretty awesome moment to show something. So when we get that teaser and, you know, I think I speak for both of us when I say we kind of want it to feel the way the Romulus thing felt. Those are all things that I would like to see. I like it to feel, you know, authentic. I want it to capture the like true vibe. And I mean that in the real sense of what Blade Runner is. The same way that Romulus captures what Alien feels like, you know, the things that make Blade Runner special, the idea of, you know, an inhuman world with humans living in it, you know, of trying to find truth in an untruthful paradigm of like seeking meaning in a what feels meaningless existence. Like if those things can kind of reverberate through this teaser, if we can feel that, then I think we're in great hands. And also, if we don't get something that feels like it's trying to be the next, you know, Game of Thrones or the next huge mega hit giant, you know, soundstage thing, if we get something that feels tight and feels special and feels like a lot of care was put into it, you know, one of the things that I love about Romulus, this teaser, is that, you know, we've been obviously freezing every frame of it and analyzing it for a couple of weeks now, and like nothing has at all distracted us. Like everything looks great, you know. Likewise, like Blade Runner, to the same degree as Alien, really deserves that. It deserves a teaser, you know, if we can just even limit ourselves to that conversation, where every frame you can pause it and you can see, like, you know, very clear Blade Runner hallmarks. You can see technology that feels like it's part of that world. I mean, you know, this is a post Sid Mead film, so like it needs to feel, you need to feel Sid Mead's presence in it. You know, this is now a post Doug Trumbull film. We need to feel Doug's presence in it. Like this is, it's really hard because a lot of the people who made Blade Runner so great, you know, are no longer with us. And now Silka and, you know, Jonathan Van Tulleken and company, they have to kind of resurrect the spirit of these people so that they can bring them and it back to life with us.
Yeah, I would agree with every single thing that you said. Just a lot of love and care needs to go into this. And again, I almost think that as much as I would have loved to have seen the show this year, the extra time, to your point, is awesome, because that means that they can make those scripts better. I hope all of the directors are able to talk with each other. I hope everyone is able to like meet together and make sure that this vision all looks the same. Sometimes Amazon's practice for their productions can be a little bit strange in terms of what department can talk to what department, and it can put a stranglehold on creativity sometimes. I have had some friends work on The Rings of Power. They said it was a very difficult shoot because there's so many things in place about who could even talk to each other. And I just really hope that Silke Louisa and all of the directors, and also importantly, the person who's doing the score, are really all on one page, and they have a clear vision for this, which I'm sure that they do. And they engage this material the way Denis engaged it, with reverence, understanding why Blade Runner is special, understanding the themes of it, but also doing their own thing. Like I think it's important that we get another Blade Runner 2049, in the sense of Denis came in and he had his own vision, he had his own aesthetic, and he created that, and he did it in a way that was very loyal to the original film while also giving us new things to see, giving us new places to go. And I hope that they do that. And I hope that nothing of this show looks cheap or feels cheap. I hope it all has that texture, either that texture of 2019 or that texture of 2049. And that Blade Runner texture is very specific. And it took Ridley Scott, as we both know, a long time to get that aesthetic. A lot of layering, a lot of building out of buildings and, you know, sets. Like, for instance, I was just watching because I was on the plane yesterday or a day before yesterday and I was bored. So I put on The Flash. And just because I'm like, let's just see how, if this film is as bad as people say. But so much of it looked like it was shot on Warner Brothers backlot. So much of it looked cheap. And so much of the CG looked cheap too. And I just was like, and then the story actually was very interesting. The story got very interesting. I didn't finish it just because the plane was landing. I'm probably not going to finish it, but I just was like, man, there's some good elements to this, but these sets just look so cheap. When they're sitting on the street corner, it looks like, I've been to the Warner Brothers lot twice. And when you can just, it feels like you're in a set. It feels like you're on a back lot. And that's what The Flash felt like. And so I really hope with the people who are creating this, and I'm sure all of the people involved, the builders, the special effects people, I'm sure they're all amazing people, but I hope the people directing them really understand what it's like to create the world of Blade Runner and how layered and atmospheric that world is. And I hope we can see it authentically. So when, I don't know, the first episode drops and we hear a boom or whatever we hear that they're going to engage us with, it is something powerful and it feels like home. I also hope that the intro titles, or what do you call those, the opening titles, hope it's really small, because all these shows, they do these like 2-minute intros. I'm like, fuck off with that. Do like a 30-second intro and get us into the show. Anyways.
Yeah, but if they're good, if those intro credits are good, like the True Detective season one intro credit, to me, that's my high watermark.
For
you
sure.
Know what I mean? I do hear you though on that. I also agree with you that there's this like impossible task that needs to happen, that it has to be new, but it also has to feel totally tied to, and you know, it has to be faithful to the source material. I think it's becoming increasingly clear to me as time goes on what a miracle Denis Villeneuve is as a filmmaker. And I think that's something that's not been lost on anybody listening to this podcast. But I mean, when 2049 came out, like that was such an impossibility. That was like such an impossibility. And then when we heard he was going to be, you know, remaking Dune or making a film out of Dune, like that was another moment where everybody was like, there's no way you could pull that off. And he did so in such a beautiful, eloquent fashion. The whole first novel is adapted now and with two magnificent movies that not only pulled off the impossible of adapting a really difficult project, but did it with such like love and care and attention to detail that they feel like utterly beautiful works of art on their own. That's like such a high watermark to hold things to. I keep using that expression tonight, but that's a high bar to be, you know, to clear for Silke Louisa for this show. I am not expecting her to do that. Like I think I'm trying to kind of like scale my expectations down a little bit so that it doesn't have to necessarily be like the life-changing quality that Denny stuff is. I don't think I need it to be that to be successful. There are things that I do need it to be. In my opinion, the way that this show is successful is again by being very, very small. I think there can be this tendency when you have access to VFX departments and, you know, the production budget of like a major streaming service to make very large palette expansive stories, Rings of Power being a great example of that, right? Where it's just this like kind of huge sprawling thing. I don't think Blade Runner works well in that environment. Like, I don't think that's kind of where it's supposed to be. Like, that's the stuff we're supposed to not really see, but to be able to intuit through what's going on in the film. I think part of my feelings on where this should go are honestly being informed by our cyberpunk conversation. You know, we talked a lot about how a lot of works get screwed up because they just try to ape the aesthetic of Blade Runner without, you know, getting to the philosophical things that underpin it. And because of that, you know, they kind of go off the rails, which is something we already, you know, kind of knew about. But when we were discussing this with Tim and with AT last month, you know, I had this moment of kind of revelation, which is so funny in retrospect because it's so obvious, but I had never considered the essential detective aspect to cyberpunk works in general. Like, I just kind of had glossed over that. Like, I thought of the film noir trappings of Blade Runner as being a stylistic choice, not necessarily like a narrative choice. But the reason it's a stylistic choice is secondary to the fact that it's a story about a detective. Like, he's, you know, he's like tracking prey. He's trying to figure out what's going on. And because of that, the world mimics that, you know, vibe in terms of, you know, it feels like a film noir. And because it feels like a film noir, it plays out in this very noir way. It has this beautiful kind of, you know, darkness to it. So I'm saying all this because I think that that's the kind of story that Blade Runner functions well with. I think it functions really, really well with small stories that have immense emotional stakes, but don't necessarily have to change the entire world. Like, that stuff can, in my opinion, happen kind of outside of the screen. Like, we can hear about how Wallace, you know, tried to save humanity or whatever. We can hear about the blackout. We can hear about cataclysms. We can hear about environmental degradation and, you know, all that stuff. But like, I don't need to see it. Like, what I want to see is a very personal story where you have a limited palette of really strong characters trying to find truth in this environment and at odds with the environment that's kind of hiding them from it, hiding it from them. So, you know, I mean, 10 hours of TV, it's probably gonna be more than 10 hours, I'm assuming, but say it's 10 hours of television. Like, that's a long story to tell. And I think the pit that a lot of things fall into when they're given that much runtime is they try to tell too much. Like, they try to cram too much narrative into it, when you can have this like beautiful other treatment where not that much really happens narratively. Like, it happens nice and slowly throughout the whole thing. It's like a big broad arc. And instead, what we have in all of that extra time is like character building and world building and just like quiet moments where the camera's not busy and where people aren't really doing anything, just to sort of inhabit spaces, you know, to be able to, like, for example, in 2049, you know, Doc Badger, that's a great character, right? Like, and his whole room is so interesting. When we see it in Black Lotus, it feels so like, I don't know, it feels like a video game cutscene to me. It feels very kind of superficial and surface level.
Yeah, very, almost, it doesn't feel authentic at all.
No. But imagine how cool it would be to have a set that has that much density to it, like it does in 2049, but in a TV show where you can have 40 minutes that just take place in that one room, you know, where characters are like having a real conversation and like taking their time with it. All of this is to say, I want this show to not feel hurried or to feel like it's trying to kind of get out of its own way. I want the show to feel like we are inhabiting the universe of a far distant future Blade Runner for at least 10 hours without feeling like we're trying to kind of be shoved through it. You know what I mean?
I do. And as you were talking, I was thinking about like what makes Blade Runner Blade Runner for me. And I'll tell you what it is. It's very easy. Yes, you have those over the big themes. Who are we? Where do we belong? How do we treat each other better? What does it mean to be human? Those are the big questions that I think Blade Runner should always ask and push to ask. But I think about moments in Blade Runner, like when Rachel comes to Deckard's apartment for the first time and she's in that fur. And there's this moment where they're talking. He's like, "You got the chills?" And he's like, "I get him too." And there's this quietness that happens between them. And then I think about the scene where Kay is outside of Stallone's and he's looking at his hands. And you see that a lot in 2049, where Kay is looking at his hands or looking at things and observing. He's just observing. There are so many quiet moments in both Blade Runner films where the characters are just observing their space or a space that they've not been in before. And they're taking their time. And I really hope 2099 is full of those quiet moments, because you need these 10 hours is enough for the story to breathe, for sure. But I need to not feel pushed through it. I need to not feel like, you know, like I don't need them to cut this action like teaser or whatever trailer to show me. Like, that's never been, Blade Runner has never been about the action. Blade Runner has been about the spirit. Blade Runner has been about the emotion. And if it becomes about the action, which is, I think, really what the downfall of Black Lotus was, where they tried to make Black Lotus and Blade Runner into this like high action, katana toting, whatever. And that's never what Blade Runner was about, but that's what it was full of. And even though those moments in that show were interesting and they were well choreographed and well put together, that's not what Blade Runner is about. So that definitely is something that pulled me right out, because Blade Runner, again, has never been about the action or the violence or the quick shots. It's always been about the patience, the time that you take. So I hope that they really understand this. I'm sure that they do. I would imagine they don't. I would imagine I need to actually even look to see what Soka Louisa looks like. I don't know what she looks like, but I would imagine they chose her because she loves Blade Runner. They chose her as a showrunner because she has things to say and she loves this world. And that's who you want. I don't know for sure if that's the case. I would imagine it is. Just as much as Denis loved Blade Runner and they chose him for it because he wants someone just like Fede Alvarez, who's doing Romulus. He loves the Alien movies, it's particularly the first two, and he's making a film based on that love. So I hope Soka Louisa and all of the directors stepping into this hallowed territory, sacred ground, do so knowing exactly what Blade Runner is. And I know we've talked about this before, about like the sacredness of Blade Runner, probably even in our last news update about 2099. Obviously, you guys are hearing us talking about this again. That's how important it is. And it's also, conversely, it's as what's also very important is that this show blow away anything that was in Black Lotus, that this show comes out feeling connected to 2049 and to the original. And we come away feeling like our lives are changed.
Just imagine the show starts and the first thing we see is a bunch of signs that say hot dog, pizza, bar, food.
Oh my God.
Yeah. I really hope, you know, I think, I felt kind of bad coming out hard on Black Lotus for a while, but you know, I think at this point, like it's okay to kind of be cranky about it. Like,
yeah, I've never felt bad about being critical, because it's not, again, we took great pains to make sure that those incredible people working on the show know that we know that they know that we respect them and the work that they do. It just fell short. It just did. Yeah, and hopefully that they own that and it is not anything on them. Things just happen. There should have been better prep for that show. It should have been given to Michael Green or someone to really baby it. I think of like Arcane on Netflix, which is this kind of cyberpunk fantasy show, which is one of the most beautiful shows. It looks like traditional animation, but it's via the computer. Really beautiful, almost like Across the Spider-Verse, same type of technology. And I've seen Blue Eye Samurai, show ran by Michael Green and his wife, who was, I think, half Japanese. And watching those shows made me think of what 2040, of what Black Lotus could have been, but wasn't, because it just wasn't in the right hands. So
yeah,
much respect to those people. It just didn't hit the mark.
Yeah. And I think I'm glad that you're framing it like that, because that's the way that I've always felt about it. Like the pedigree of that show, the people working on it was incredible. And it's just one of those things where like it wasn't as good as the sum of its parts was kind of worse than the things that made it up. You know what I mean? Mm. And that's the trouble we could have with Black Lotus too. And I mean, not Black Lotus, with 2099 too, you know, like we know we have really great talent attached to it. And it's entirely possible that it won't click. And then we're going to have 10 plus hours of mediocre Blade Runner content, but that's okay. You know, like we live in a world where stuff comes out that's great and stuff comes out that's not great, and you know, it's not going to kill anybody, you know.
Yeah, but so to that point though, I think that we should be honest, not that we're never honest with that, not that we're not honest with our listeners, but so Black Lotus was hard for us to get through. We didn't like it so much that we didn't want to cover it. We didn't, and we really mostly didn't. I mean, we did we did some big picture episodes on Black Lotus, but we did not like that show. We didn't want to talk about it. It's hard to talk about something that you're just going to criticize again and again and again. So it's also the reason why we don't really ever talk about Black Lotus. And when it comes up and we're very disappointed in it. So the idea that we could have a live action show that you and I are like, do we have to talk about this? Oh my God, that would be devastating for me. Devastating.
Yeah, but we could still just talk about the movies. You know, that's the good thing. Like at the end of the day, we still have amazing works of art that don't go anywhere. You know what I mean?
True.
Obviously, that's not what I want to happen. And I don't think it's going, again, I don't think that's what's going to happen at all.
Agreed.
But it is weird. You know, you're bringing something up that I honestly haven't even considered until you just said it, which is that, like, there is more Blade Runner Black Lotus than there are Blade Runner movies.
Yes.
Which is weird to think about, right? We only have the two films. We have like 7 hours of Black Lotus or whatever that was.
Yeah.
And we never talk about it, like, ever. Like, those themes don't make sense for us. Like, the way that it was executed doesn't make sense for us. It just feels like,
doesn't even feel like the same world.
It doesn't feel like it even happens sometimes to me, you know, because I just really don't think about it very much.
It's also not promoted either. Like, and I think hopefully with Amazon in the mix, I think, and I did say this in our last episode, hopefully they really promote this really well. Black Lotus was promoted, but it was on Crunchyroll, which for a lot of people were like, well, how do I get to Crunchyroll? It was very difficult to find. It was very, even though, I mean, it was an app that you could download and then you'd have to like cast it to your TV. I think it's on HBO Max right now. It was, at least. I don't know if it's still there.
And I watched it on Apple TV when it came out.
Did you?
Just paid for it, yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay. But I just hope that... And they also fell short with the release, the physical release of 2049. I mean, it just it wasn't released with the pedigree that the original was. It doesn't have any kind of long documentary. The art was terrible. The poster was terrible. It was all done with people's eyes closed.
Do you remember the first time that the orange and teal poster came out?
Oh my God.
Do you remember how disappointing that was? Because we had been seeing like the most extraordinary fan art for this thing, like in the months before that poster came out. And it was like any one of those would have been so great. And then they went with like the worst.
They went with the worst. Poster. Yeah. Like, green and teal, or teal, whatever.
Orange and teal.
And it was just, but so, not to harp on that too much, but there are some unfinished things in this world, and 2049, as it's in its physical release, is unfinished. That film did not get the release that it deserves. It didn't get a poster that it deserved, didn't get a documentary or any of the care that went into the original. So I'm hoping that Amazon and the people involved in their promotional department and their marketing department really take this and understand how interesting and special and authentic this IP is, and they give it the kind of treatment that you just don't see. I mean, I think about The Boys. The art for The Boys is great. Like, the show's great too. They really just nailed the aesthetic. Like, you look at the poster, you look at the promotional items for The Boys, it feels like the show. With 2049. And
look at the documentaries too, like every single episode has after shows on it. They have a whole separate show on Prime that's just like talking about the show itself. They had Gen V come out, which was also exquisite. They love that show, and they remake the whole Prime landing. Like, when the new seasons come out, like, the whole Prime landing page has like Boys stuff all over it, you know, and it's very subversive and kind of gross and funny. And like, I mean, that's amazing. And that's Amazon, you know, but it's amazing. I mean, and that, like, that when 2099 comes out, imagine if it has that too. If you go onto the app and the whole thing is kind of remade in this Blade Runner aesthetic, like,
that'd be awesome.
Would it be to have Silke Louisa doing narrated, you know, like doing a separate audio track or something, or using the X-ray feature that Amazon uses to give you lots of background. And like, they could really water this garden in some really beautiful ways.
They could. And Amazon tends to do, like, for The Rings of Power, which I did watch in its entirety because I'm a Tolkien fan and a fantasy fan. But for The Rings of Power, like, the behind the scenes was like integrated. So you'd have to watch the show again. I was like, I'm not watching the show again, just because I was entertained by it, but it was not a good first season. I don't even think about it. But I don't want to, when I want to watch behind the scenes for 2099, I mean, well, number one, I do hope I will, like, yes, let's watch it again. But I really hope they do something separate. I hope that they produce a documentary for that show that's separate, that I don't have to get into it and watch it again. It's a little bit of a ploy, because it forces you to watch it again. And so algorithmically, it perks up their numbers for sure. So yes, someone's watching the show again and they're watching it this way. But these films/shows deserve behind the scenes making of documentaries that are 1 to 2 hours, expansive, exhaustive, the way Dangerous Days was. Dangerous Days is like 3 hours long. Something like that's the bar. And I really hope going forward that Alcon rethinks a re-release for 2049 and really gives it the release it deserves. And Amazon takes 2099 by the reins, by the horns, whatever, and gives us something in all quadrants that's amazing. Whether it's the poster, the score release, the trailers, all that. And again, this probably sounds like a lot of expectation, but this is what we've come to expect, right? Should we not expect this?
It's Blade Runner, yeah. It's one of the great properties that exists in Hollywood, you know?
For sure.
One thing, you know, as we kind of wrap up here that I want to say, this is something we've been dealing with quite a bit on our Alien show, is the notion of spoilers. So, of course, this is not filming quite yet. It's going to start like any day now if it hasn't already started. But it's, you know, this doesn't exist yet in the world. It will in the next few months. Like, we will have actual things happening and, you know, people on set filming things in the very near future. And that brings with it the real likelihood of leaks coming out. Jamie and I and our other co-host Christian on Perfect Organism came to a decision that we were not going to be sharing spoilers about Alien Romulus, even though we have had access to many of them for a long time. And even though we continue to get access to them now in some ways, you know, we don't share anything without like express permission from the people who made it. And beyond that, we still exercise a separate layer of caution in terms of, do we think this will best serve the fan experience in terms of this movie coming out and setting expectations properly and making sure people are excited about it. We decided with Romulus, like I said, we're basically only going to cover things that are coming out from the studio. So like when, you know, promotional materials, the teaser comes out, we will talk about that and analyze the shit out of it, but we're not going to spoil things. Likewise, for Blade Runner 2099, I hope we will have access to things that potentially could be spoilers. I hope we get better access with Alcon. I hope we have a good, you know, relationship with Warner Brothers and everybody who's making, it's not Warner Brothers actually this time, it's Amazon Prime, but, you know, with Prime Video, with the people who are making it. And we will continue to exercise great caution not to spoil things for you, the listener, even if they become spoiled for us in the process. So you can really trust us as a place that's like safe, that is not going to mess up your experience. And, you know, we talked a lot about this, Jamie, Christian, and I, with Alien, where we were like, you know, we really exist for the fan community. Like, we are members of the fan community. We are stewards of the fan experience. And that is the way we approach our job with these shows, is to cultivate a better fan experience for all of us. And that includes not spoiling things, because we think one of the great pleasures in life is being surprised when you go see, you know, an amazing work of art. So again, you'll be safe listening to this show in the coming months. Don't worry about it. Likewise, with our social media, we're not going to be sharing things that are spoilery. If other outlets do, we can't do anything about that, but we will not.
I guess that's a wrap. We'll be back next month with Blade Runner 2049 and Cyberpunk. We're going to reconvene everyone, myself, Patrick, T.R. Napper, our friend AT, to talk about what's cyberpunk about Blade Runner 2049. Is it more cyberpunk than the original, and what that means, and the themes of 2049 as discussed through the lens of cyberpunk. So I'm excited about that. So stay
tuned. Yes, indeed. Thanks, everybody.
To find out more about Shoulder of Orion, the Blade Runner podcast, please visit www.bladerunnerpodcast.com. If you'd like to support the show, please visit bladerunnerpodcast.com/support. Thank you.